Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Hackers have been making headlines with the recent sentencing of Jeremy Hammond. The 28-year-old activist received the maximum 10 years in jail for releasing private information gathered by hacking the servers of Strategic Forecasting Incorporated, also known as Stratfor. Jeremy Hammond targeted Stratfor and a number of other law enforcement institutions, military manufacturers, and information security firms. At his hearing, he said, quote, "I hacked into dozens of high-profile corporations and government institutions, understanding very clearly that what I was doing was against the law and that my actions could land me back in federal prison. But I felt that I had an obligation to use my skills to expose and confront injustice and to bring the truth to light," end quote. In other cases, hackers are getting involved in order to enforce justice when the system appears to have failed. The hacker collective Anonymous brought attention to two rape cases this past year in Steubenville, Ohio, and Maryville, Missouri. In both cases, rape charges were brought against high school athletes and were subsequently dropped by the courts, despite evidence to the contrary. Well, Anonymous brought media attention to the two cases, creating a huge national outcry. In Steubenville, the accused football stars received 3 years total for their crime of raping an unconscious young girl, while 26-year-old Derek Lutz's daughter, the hacktivist who exposed them, faces 25 years in prison, and his home has been raided by the FBI for hacking the football team's website and accessing private emails. So online activists and hackers are proving that they have real power to affect change. But what are the results, good and bad, of vigilante justice online? And should we call it vigilante justice? How are governments responding to hackers? And what is the value of due process if, for example, rapists get away and whistleblowers are criminalized working for public safety? Joining us to talk about these issues is Quinn Norton, a journalist covering hacker culture, Anonymous, and the Occupy movement. Her work has appeared in many publications, including Wired and The Guardian. Hi, Quinn. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Ricardo Dominguez is associate professor in the Visual Arts Department at the University of San Diego. He's co-founder of the Electronic Disturbance Theater. That's a hacktivist group that developed virtual sit-in technologies in solidarity with the Zapatista communities in Chiapas, Mexico. Hi, Ricardo. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. And Hadar Aviram is professor of law at UC Hastings and co-chair of the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice. Hadar's research focuses on the criminal justice system and examines policing, courtroom practices, and policy decisions. She runs the California Correctional Crisis blog and is writing a book called Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment. Hi, Hadar. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So, Quinn, let's start off with you. Anonymous gets a lot of attention, but a lot of people don't really understand what it does. And it's really amazing to read about just various cases that it gets itself involved in. I mean, we've got groups doing everything from protesting surveillance to dismantling security. There's also a group, I love this one, called Anonymous, M-I-S-S, and they advocate for women's rights. So how would you describe Anonymous?
I've often described Anonymous as a kind of culture rather than an organization. Anonymous is a way of kind of taking up a set of aesthetics and usually a set of values that goes with it and kind of going after the thing that you care about. So it's very much not a traditional organization. The political campaigns it engages in are campaigns of interest. They're kind of people that just get together and decide to do it. And they may have no connection with the rest of the collective, or they may, or that their connection to the rest of the collective may grow over time from deciding to take on the aspect of Anonymous and act in their local community or about a global issue that they care about.
Would you say that there's sort of like a social justice element to Anonymous and then a number of other things? Because I have a friend who spends a lot of time in the hacker community online, and she's a young woman, and she says a lot of it can be pretty nasty.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's as many aspects to some degree as there is reasons for joining Anonymous. Everyone kind of makes their own Anonymous. And it's interesting. Some of it is pretty rough, and it serves a couple of functions. kind of culturally for that environment to be pretty rough. One is it kind of keeps the straights out, for want of a better term there. It keeps people who are going to be too restrictive on what people do away from the collective. And I don't think it's a conscious decision. Well, that's actually a semi-conscious decision dating back from their origin on 4chan, of just kind of wanting to remain self-activated and free to do whatever they want. So it kind of keeps people who would try and step in and co-opt the group from a social perspective out. Doesn't stop law enforcement from co-opting the group, but that's a different matter. And the other thing, and it's really, really an interesting emergent property that nastiness serves, which is that if everything is offensive all the time, nothing is really offensive. You have to really go out of your way to be truly offensive in that environment. If you know that everything's going to be offensive, it allows people to work cross-culturally in a way that has proven very difficult for traditional organizations. If you've got people working in the Middle Eastern context and the American context, and they all know that they're constantly going to say offensive things to each other because that's the rules of the shared space, saying offensive things to each other doesn't actually get in the way of working together.
And Ricardo, how does Anonymous differ from a group like yours, your hacktivist group, the Electronic Disturbance Theater?
Well, in the early 90s, when we began to theorize the practice of electronic civil disobedience, we decided not to be anonymous, that is, to be radically transparent, to bring our data bodies and real bodies together, both online and in the street. And so when we did virtual sit-ins against the Mexican government or the DOD, WTO, IMF, or what have you, we always let that group know who we were, where we lived, our telephone numbers. The code was as openly available as it can possibly be in terms of HTML. And so it was a way to think of putting one's body online. That is, Gandhi spoke of Satyagraha when one trespassed and blocked in the streets. And so this was our way of thinking that question, that is, radical transparency, would probably be the key difference between the way that Anonymous has organized and this tradition of electronic civil disobedience that the Electronic Disturbance Theater established in the 90s.
And we have some listeners who don't really spend that much time online. What do you mean when you say electronic civil disobedience?
Well, traditionally, going back to Thoreau and on civil disobedience, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, nonviolent actions that were based on civil disobedience were about trespass and blockage. One gathered in a mass or as individuals and sat in the office of the President of the United States, or blocked a street. And one wasn't destroying the street or destroying the elements of furnishing, if you will, in an office, but because there was a mass of humanity there, it made it very difficult for cars to move through the street.
Oh. You know, I think we're having a bad line. Ricardo, I think we have a bad line. We'll give you a call right back. And Hadar, you follow this in terms of, you know, how governments are responding. And I should say, we did call the FBI, and they said, we do not talk about Anonymous. And the Department of Homeland Security declined our invitation. I mean, it's so massive when you start reading about what these activists are doing. Who's keeping tabs on all of this, especially when we're talking about people like Jeremy Hammond, who hack into corporate systems, or the young men, for example, who exposed the rape cases in Steubenville, Ohio, and Maryville, Missouri? Who's keeping track?
So one of the things to keep in mind is that, as is the case with any crime, enforcement is not completely uniform. And the authorities can't enforce the law against everybody who they perceive as breaking the law. They definitely have to make some priorities. And it's also important to state that given the availability of technology and the skills that people have, we've become a culture of documenters. And privacy has lost some of its meaning, and confidentiality has lost some of its meaning. And in this sea of people who document things on their phone, who hack into computers, who do a lot of activity around online exposure of what's happening in the world, the law has reacted to this in a fairly schizophrenic way. It is pursuing some people while leaving other people alone, and I think that when we're talking about this, we need to keep in mind not only the over-enforcement aspects of this, but also the under-enforcement aspects of this. So a lot of the energy has been directed toward these folks who expose federal secrets. And this is partly because the way we've structured the whistleblower protections has been forever very, very problematic. It very much depends on discretion on the part of the government. And obviously the government is not going to have, you know, a lot of goodwill toward folks exposing things that the government would prefer not to see exposed. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot of folks trying to do vigilante justice using their cell phones in public places, posting images out of context without, you know, the due process and proof that we're used to seeing, and, you know, on occasion leading to blaming innocent people for horrific things, and that sometimes passes by, you know, unenforced, unnoticed, and unaddressed.
So, for example, I mean, I find this case of Jeremy Hammond pretty fascinating. This is the anonymous hacktivist who released millions of emails about the private intelligence firm Stratfor, and he got the maximum 10 years in prison. He's 28. He called the sentence a vengeful, spiteful act. He gave an interview to The Guardian. Were you surprised when you heard about this sentence?
I'm always surprised when the day I stop being surprised by harsh sentences is the day I'm going to leave my job, I think. So I'm never jaded about these things. But I can't say that I was completely stunned. I mean, we've seen this kind of reaction from the government with the Assange issue. We've seen it with the Snowden, you know, recent discoveries about the NSA. We've seen some of this animus operating in the Chelsea Manning case. We're seeing the government very, very concerned about this. And I think partly there's this fear that folks who operate in the framework of technology and hacking are somehow all-powerful, they have, you know, access to everybody, who knows what else they might uncover. So a lot of the harsh reaction is the result of panic and fear.
Quinn.
I think also, yeah, just to real quickly to come in on that, I think also there's an opportunism. I think there's a public panic, and I'm not sure how many prosecutors actually are terrified of hackers and how much this is like a new, very small drug war where they can get away with very harsh sentences, very high-profile cases. They get a lot of kudos for what they've done, but there's not much understanding of what's going on, and so there's not much public outcry or defense of the people that this happens to.
Can you?
I think that's absolutely right. Moral panic is always this kind of feedback loop between politicians, the people, and the media, and they all feed into each other. And I think what's frightening in this case, or at least that's how the media capitalizes on these cases, not only the sensitivity of the discoveries, but also the scale and the extent of the intrusion.
Well,
perceived intrusion.
Say also,
Sorry, Ricardo, unfortunately we're still having some problems with your line. I gave a couple examples, Quinn. We talked about Jeremy Hammond, who hacked into Stratfor, and then Derek Lostutter, the hacktivist who exposed the rape in Steubenville, who's facing 25 years in prison. Can you give us some other cases of high-profile cases?
Well, the PayPal 14 or 16. I can't remember if it's 14 or 16. The PayPal case was a case dating back from 2010, or the action was, where these people ended up downloading a tool called Loic, and they just pointed a great deal of browser traffic at PayPal. PayPal went down. Now, my understanding, having researched that incident, is that PayPal very likely did not go down because of Loic. It went down because somebody with a And it never really completely went down. It got slow for a while. But those people who downloaded that tool and sent some of the browser traffic to PayPal, leaving a trace at PayPal every time they did that. And they were 14 of thousands that were picked out and charged with hacking, essentially. And they're facing many, many years in prison for this really, really insignificant act. And it's kind of, if you know anything about computers, if you're part of computer culture, it's mind-boggling. It's essentially like these people are facing years in prison for hitting reload really fast on their browser.
Wow. And are these mostly young men who are taking part in these actions?
If you look at the PayPal 14, you get a huge range. You get teenage men, but you get middle-aged housewives as well.
Really?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Wow. I mean, there is a group of young men that are involved in hacktivism, and they've become like the public face of hacktivism for many people, and certainly the media narrative. But it's actually a pretty inaccurate vision, because there's a huge amount of diversity kind of behind that, especially as you move around the world, because you have Anons in, you know, everywhere from Tunisia to Egypt and Indonesia. Southeast Asia is having a big upsurgence of anonymous activists now that are dealing with kind of governmental abuse over there. There's like an anonymous cleaning crew out of Japan that just goes and cleans the streets. And that's actually an interesting point. I think one of the things that people lose track of with Anonymous is that the vast majority of the time, isn't really political activism. It's just kind of hanging out.
That is Quinn Norton, a journalist covering hacker culture, Anonymous, and the Occupy movement. Ricardo Dominguez is associate professor in the visual arts department at UC San Diego, or University of San Diego, co-founder of the Electronic Disturbance Theater, a hacktivist group. And Hadar Aviram is professor of law at UC Hastings and co-chair of the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice. And today we are talking about Anonymous and online hackers. They are receiving a lot of attention in the media because these people are receiving pretty long jail sentences. Jeremy Hammond recently received a 10-year sentence for hacking into the private information firm Strategic Forecasting, also known as Stratfor. He says he did it to expose and confront injustice and to bring truth to light. A lot of hackers got involved in the rape cases in Steubenville, Ohio, and Maryville, Missouri, when charges were brought against athletes, high school athletes, and then dropped. And then once Anonymous got involved, it created a national outcry. So what are your thoughts on Anonymous and online hacking? What questions do you have about what they do? What do you think is acceptable? How do you feel about these people stepping up when the justice system or the government fails? Do you think it's fair to call them vigilantes? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. If you're involved in this kind of work, we'd love to hear from you. Again, we did reach out to the FBI, but they said that they do not talk about Anonymous, and the Department of Homeland Security declined our invitation. So, Hadar, when it comes to law enforcement, what are the legalities surrounding this?
So we have a fairly complicated web of federal legislation to protect whistleblowers. And this dates back to the 70s, where the idea was to try and help whistleblowers avoid repercussions and retaliation when they're exposing important things, when they're exposing waste, when they're exposing abuse, and things like that. The problem is not so much with the process. The problem is with the discretion that's built into the process. And the laws have changed over the years, from the 70s to the 90s. After the Challenger disaster, there were some changes to legislation then. The problem is not so much with the structure of legislation itself. The problem is that if somebody is trying to benefit from whistleblower protection, they're often encountering very bad government animus, and the government doesn't really accept their appeals. The process is a governmental process. And whistleblowers don't tend to fare very well in the process itself. Moreover, the protections of the Whistleblower Act don't really extend to some groups. They didn't extend, as we all recently know, to Edward Snowden and to Julian Assange. So this is not so much a problem of the law as it is a problem of the way the law is being enforced and the discretion that goes into the process.
So, for example, in the case of Jeremy Hammond, who received 10 years, he was sentenced in federal court in Manhattan, and he pleaded guilty to one count under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Yes, and here's the thing. The prosecutions don't just happen on their own. Prosecutions happen because somebody at the DA's office or at the U.S. Attorney's office decides to bring the case forth. They don't just occur. And somebody made a decision to seek a particular type of punishment and to pursue the case in a particular way. And it's not particularly surprising that they chose to do so in a case that involved sensitive discoveries.
Well, especially as the FBI had been somewhat running the group that Jeremy Hammond was in for the last 9 months.
Oh, yeah. Can you talk about that, Quinn?
Okay. Essentially, when Antisec formed, which is a wing, Antisec was a small group, kind of much more like a traditional group of people inside of Anonymous. It was never uncontroversial within Anonymous. The idea of having a small closed group that went out and hacked things was something that a lot of Anons were not comfortable with, and other Anons found heroic. So you had a lot of debate about that. But it turned out that one of the most high profile of them was an Anon that went by Sabu, and Sabu was working for the FBI the whole time. And he didn't run the group, but he did a lot of management of the group, and certainly the Strat4 hack wouldn't have happened without Sabu facilitating the whole thing, or facilitating access to the Strat4 servers.
So is it accurate to assume that a number of FBI informants are involved with Anonymous?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, nobody knows how many. Eric Corley of 2600 is estimated up to 1 in 4 people in the hacker community as an informant of some sort. I don't know how you'd even measure that. There was a document that Anonymous leaked some time ago, I think in 2011, that was detailing the fact that European law enforcement agencies were having problems trying to collar each other while spying on Anonymous, just like they were in there trying to kind of find the other hackers, and they ended up spending more time chatting up with each other than they did with real hackers.
We reached out to Anonymous, but they don't have a very good, they don't really like the media very much. They've got some nasty things to say about the media, to say the least.
No, it depends on who you're talking to. I mean, you know, obviously there's some that really like the media. In some ways, they're media hackers. There's no spokesperson, so you end up ascribing an opinion to Anonymous that is the opinion of the first person you manage to find and talk to.
Well, and I'm sure because we reached out to them, you know, this time for one radio show. I mean, if we were writing a lengthy feature, it would probably be a little easier to create a relationship, I'm assuming, because you'd have time to go back and forth.
Also, you just have to find ones that are more media-friendly. Like, there's no common opinion. There are very, very few common values in Anonymous. There are a few. They're anti-censorship. They're pro-free speech. Now, what that means for each individual Anon can be slightly different. They tend to be individualistic in their view of rights and somewhat collectivist in their view of operations. But at any point, you know, it's very, very hard, and I say this as someone who's studied them for years now, to say what Anonymous thinks about anything.
Hmm.
They also have an internal rule, like one of the only, I don't know, I was just watching the Pirates of the Caribbean with my daughter, and I was thinking of the point where the captain says that there are more guidelines than rules, but one of them is that you don't attack the media.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, and I know we have to let you go in about 30 seconds, Quinn. How do they decide what to take on? I mean, for example, like when the rape, when the football players, when the case was dropped by the courts, how do they decide to say, you know what, we're going to get involved in this rape case in Steubenville, Ohio?
This is actually a really interesting process. This is one of the most interesting things that I can think has kind of emerged from online culture and online culture in general, but it sees like a really interesting refined form in Anonymous, which is that they are, as Clay Shirky put it online, they are a published and select culture. We're used to a select and publish culture. We're used to, like, we do careful selection, and then there's an announcement, or there's something published, or there's an organization or something like that after we've done selection. In Anonymous, if you're interested in doing something, if you're thinking, I really hate this rape case and I want to get Anonymous behind it, you make the announcement. You start the movement. You're like, well, we're doing this now. And if you get a critical mass of people kind of coming to your banner, then it happens.
Hmm.
If you don't, it doesn't happen.
Well,
so I would periodically get these calls from journalists who would say, hey, I found an announcement that Anonymous is going to take down Facebook. Are they going to take down Facebook?
Right.
And
well,
like, you have to go to these rooms and lurk and find out.
Well, I know we have to let you go, so thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
That's Quinn Norton. She's a journalist who covers these issues, and you can find her work at our website. And we'll be back to talk about Anonymous after this.
Your call is always better when more folks get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can send your question or comment via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. KALW is a media sponsor for the Berklee Symphony, which continues its 2013-14 season with music from contemporary Australian composer Brett Dean, paired with two masterworks from the classical repertoire on Thursday, December 5th at 8 p.m. in Zellerbach Hall. Music director Joanne Carnero leads the orchestra in Dean's Carlo, inspired by the music of Italian Renaissance composer Carlo Gesualdo. Also, cellist Peter Weirich performs Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 1. Full concert information at berkeleysymphony.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how independent musicians make ends meet. Because of services like Spotify and YouTube, musicians are constantly looking for new ways to earn a living. So how do they do it? And what questions do you have? And if you're an independent musician, we'd love to hear from you on tomorrow's show. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about online hacking. A number of hackers have been making headlines recently. Jeremy Hammond, a 28-year-old activist, received the maximum 10 years in jail for releasing private information gathered by hacking the servers of Stratfor. A number of hackers exposed the rape cases in Steubenville, Ohio, and Maryville, Missouri. 26-year-old Derek Lustutter, the hacktivist who exposed the case in Steubenville, is facing 25 years in prison, more time than the accused football players received. They got 3 years for raping an unconscious young girl. So we're talking about these groups, how they get involved. What are your thoughts about how governments respond? The FBI declined our invitation, saying we do not talk about Anonymous. The Department of Homeland Security also declined our invitation. So what are your thoughts about these groups taking the law into their own hands? What do you think is justified? What isn't? If you're involved in any group like this, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Today, we're joined by Hadar Aviram, professor of law at UC Hastings and co-chair of the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice. Ricardo Dominguez is associate professor in the Visual Arts Department at the University of San Diego, co-founder of the Electronic Disturbance Theater, a hacktivist group that developed virtual sit-in technologies in solidarity with the Zapatista communities. And Ricardo, can you talk a little bit about other forms of hacktivism outside of Anonymous?
Well, I think what's important is that during the 90s, the RAND Corporation established a sort of overview of cyber war, cyber terrorism, and cyber crime. And now we tend to put those things together. And one of the things that has begun, that occurred in the 90s, was that different groups attempted forms of culture jamming, tactical media, disturbances of virtual digital structures, and often they were based not so much on anonymity, but on being present and available, either as groups that formed around coherent movements or actions. And so, for instance, one of the outcomes of these type of gestures that were not anonymous was that we did begin to see the outcome of some early legal precedents around defining civil disobedience in terms of digital culture in relation to what we know as the history of civil disobedience versus the kind of actions that are taking place against anonymous, which we might call cracker or cracktivist. That is, those who break into systems to get information. So, for instance, in 2000, Electronics Disturbance Theater worked with a German hacker group called Chaos Computer Club to do a series of virtual actions against Lufthansa for their deportation class actions. That is, the German government was paying them to deport people, and they would bind them up like mummies. They would put motorcycle helmets on these immigrants. Many of them died in process. And so we decided to take on Lufthansa over this issue. And Lufthansa responded by saying that these were cyber terrorist acts. And so they arrested a number of the people, system administrators. And when they went before the court, Lufthansa and the court decided that they had suffered economic losses. The Lufthansa site had gone down. And so the German government decided that these individuals had to be imprisoned under Kind Eva's cyber terrorist frame. But a year later, the higher court of Frankfurt overturned this ruling and stated that these actions of online demonstration did not constitute a show of force, but were intended to influence public opinion. So basically, the ideas behind electronic civil disobedience, tactical media, digital jamming, aren't necessarily focused on cracking into systems to get information, but about distributing information. It's an informational politics. So this history from the 90s and 80s, I think, allowed the first conversation of a difference between what we imagine as hacktivism and cracktivism. And it seems to me at this particular point with Anonymous that governmental policies are really concerned over the issue of cracktivism as the key point of the way they choose their cases.
And Hadar, you talked about this briefly earlier, that it's interesting to look at when the government takes action and when it doesn't. What really strikes you about that?
Well, I think that the distinctions that we make between hacktivism and documenting things all around us can be pretty nebulous at best. The obvious case that pops to mind, for me at least, is New Year's Eve of 2009, when dozens of people used their cell phones to film how a BART police officer shot Oscar Grant to death on the platform of the Fruitvale BART station. That case would not have been brought to justice probably without the intervention of those folks who documented what they were seeing. And we want to applaud that to some extent. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot of cases online of people posting videos, presumably to bring people to justice for a variety of offenses, for being annoying, for parking in the handicapped parking, for doing, you know, a lot of things that they shouldn't be doing. But they post them completely out of context and without any idea of what they're looking at. The risk there is that somebody who's completely innocent can be maligned online, the reputation can be shot without real proof of their guilt. And those things tend to go unaddressed, even when we're talking about things like revenge porn and all sorts of interpersonal disputes that people solve by posting all sorts of maligning information on the other person online. And that goes overlooked. And I think that this tells us something about the motivation of the government in addressing some of these issues, particularly when people expose things that are uncomfortable for the government, rather than when people are being malicious or use poor judgment to criminalize other people.
Well, and then in the case of Jeremy Hammond, they're obviously trying to send a strong message.
They are. And I think one of the issues that, since we've started talking, that keeps popping into my mind is the Steubenville issue.
Mm.
None of us would have known about what was going on if it weren't for someone who exposed it.
Right.
Now, here we have a person who is fairly bravely standing against rape culture and against the culture that affirms that doing what these folks did is fine. And we're seeing the system basically enforce that message by saying that what happened is not as serious as the exposure of what happened, which also raises all sorts of interesting...
Go ahead.
It also raises all sorts of interesting issues about the concept of privacy. You know, on one hand, we know that filming, you know, somebody being shot to death on a BART platform is legal and is fine. And on the other hand, while we're being told that emails are never private and that we should be very, very cautious about what we put online or what we write in an email to somebody else because we have no expectation of privacy in these methods, here is someone who is exposing emails and he's being put on trial for it.
You wanted to jump in, Ricardo?
Well, I think this is, in a sense, the condition in which we are now living in a informational society, in which questions of access, questions of filtration, questions of blocking are part of the civil discourse that has to occur. And we are often reactive, that is, we... let certain states of law define the questions of justice. and also because it becomes very chaotic in that you have a lot of this lowercase bullying and aggression, which is also part of this informational society. So one particular tactic that we have taken is this issue of radical transparency, and that is accepting that there is this particular space of time that we live in which nothing can really be secreted or blocked or fully opaque. And so to try to participate consistently in that kind of under-the-wire culture doesn't necessarily always lead to having a policy conversation with those elements that do begin to define what sort of legal outcomes occur, such as in the case of an individual sharing information, getting 20 years for it, and people who actually did the act of violence only getting 3. Hmm. So that at this particular point, then, what we do get in informational society is that the data body becomes a much more a powerful focus, not only in terms of virtual economies, but in what is defined as the quality of the law. So that if you break the terms of the data body, whatever one imagines that to be, it becomes a much more violent response by the social structure, such as the legal codes, than what one does physically. So that is images that are represented and distributed. All those qualities of the data body become, how shall I say, transcendental or above the actual enactments of the everyday imagined human body. I don't know if that distinction is as clear as it could be, but that is that our informational bodies, our databases, our transactions are seen as much more important in informational society than what we do in the everyday with our real bodies. So if you break the informational laws, you will end up being incarcerated for 20 years as opposed to going and raping an unconscious young woman.
And again, the football players who were found guilty received 3 years total. It's 2 football players. And 26-year-old Derek Lestutter, the hacktivist who exposed the rape, faces 25 years in prison, and his home has been raided by the FBI for hacking the football team's website and accessing private emails. And we did reach out to the FBI. They said they don't talk about Anonymous, and the Department of Homeland Security also said that they couldn't come on today's show. That is Ricardo Dominguez. He's associate professor in the Visual Arts Department at the University of San Diego. He's co-founder of the Electronic Disturbance Theater, a hacktivist group that developed virtual sit-in technologies in solidarity with the Zapatista communities. Hadar Aviram is professor of law at UC Hastings and co-chair of the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice. Today we're talking about online activists and Anonymous. These groups are becoming very powerful, exposing many, many things, including these rape cases, secrets from various corporations. What are your thoughts on this? A lot of them say that they're trying to expose the truth and injustice. What questions do you have about these groups? What about how the government is responding to these groups? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Question. To me, maybe the best protest of, not even recent times, but of the last half century was Mario Savio delivering that blistering, riveting speech on the steps at the Sproul Plaza at Berkeley in the 1965 or 6. And it's on YouTube. It's a very stirring 60 minutes. So there was a 60 seconds. And now there's someone who came out, and that's the kind of speechifying or oratory, if you will, I was hoping to find with Anonymous, and didn't hear a single voice that said anything to me. I think Robert Reich was the closest, but yeah, he was pontificating for a couple hours. So I'm a little disappointed in anonymity that way, that nothing, the movement hasn't produced a Mario Savio. However, I think it was one of the writings of Glenn Greenwald on Mark Felt's Deep Throat's Death that pointed out that Julian Assange made a big mistake by making himself known by going unanonymous, because then the message became about him rather than the information that he was revealing.
Hmm.
What do you think about that? And if the Hastings law professor is on there, is there? I mean, what do you advise people who are about to leak information? I certainly myself would not want to be a Julian Assange on the run trying to find a country that would take me. The mental pressure would not make life very pleasant.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling. Hadar, what are your thoughts on that?
So there's a couple of things to keep in mind. I adore Mario Savio's speech as well, and I think that it's important to keep the historical context in mind. The 60s were very different. It was a very special moment in American history. It was a moment that had a very interesting and complicated relationship with protest, and it was a moment at which we hadn't become jaded yet, and there was a lot more optimism around actions of protest. And I think things have changed. I think there's also the question of what people are trying to get. I think that speaking to people and putting art and into the action of protest is still a valuable thing if you're trying to bring something, make something on the table and make a statement. I think what a lot of the hacktivists are trying to do, and this is partly why the anonymity, is that there's an effort to expose things that are unexposed, and I think part of the power of that, it's just a different form of protest, part of the power of that lies in the anonymity of the people who are doing it. As far as giving people practical advice what to do, I'm a member of the California Bar. I would never advise anybody to break the law. but it is very, very complicated to give somebody advice ex ante in cases like this, because it's very difficult to see what is going to draw governmental ire. I mean, if I'm looking at, you know, the way that the government has been conceptualizing privacy and you know, anonymity as part of that in the last few decades, we're seeing that gradually the message that the Supreme Court has been sending to all of us in a variety of contexts is that there is no such thing as privacy. That we have a certain modicum of privacy in our homes, but we don't have a modicum of privacy in our cars, in our roads, in our actions, in our personal communications, and gradually we don't have any sort of guarantee that what we tell a friend is going to remain secret, for example. Our comings and goings are not private. So on one hand, there's this message that you, whatever it is that you put online, you should expect somebody to reveal it, and that would be okay because your expectation of privacy is unreasonable. On the other hand, when the privacy that you're violating is the government's privacy, all of that all of a sudden doesn't exist, and you're being put on trial for exposing these sensitive things. So it's a very, very tricky situation to give people advice on.
Well, and in the recent cases we've been talking about, I mean, these are huge issues. Do you think, Hadar, it's safe to say that if these activists didn't get involved in the rape cases in Steubenville, Ohio, and Maryville, Missouri, that they would have just gone away quietly?
I'm pretty sure, and that's because there is an entire culture in some towns in America that worships and basically takes anything that is done by local sports stars as the gospel. Nobody would care. The town reveres them because they're football stars. Nobody would know or pay attention that there's anything that is wrong here. There is still a huge culture of misogyny and victim shaming, and whoever did that did a huge, whoever exposed this culture and its manifestation in that horrific case did an amazing service to women all around America.
And in the case of Steubenville, one of the 19 football coaches accused the young girl of making it up and said that people are trying to blow up our football program because of it. Who is going after Derek Lustdaughter, and why does he face up to 25 years in prison for hacking into the football player's website?
Again, as I said before, prosecutions don't just happen. They are the product of prosecutorial discretion. Somebody has given this some thought. Maybe they've been watching this guy for other reasons. I mean, there is a lot that could go into the decision whether to prosecute and what sort of penalty to ask for in cases like this. Just as a sort of balance to that someone is facing a particular maximum punishment doesn't necessarily mean that that's what they're going to get. The system often charges people, overcharges people, and threatens them with heavy sentences, trying to create an incentive to plead guilty.
Also, it allows them to create a chilling effect over these informational politics, which are now participating in multiple ways to enunciate problems in culture internationally, nationally, and locally. And so one of the ways that authorities often create a chilling effect is, of course, targeting one individual within a larger group. And often a lot of this prosecutions are around the issue of cracking. That is, that somehow this individual imagined or proved that they got into the system, that they got into somebody's computer and accessed information, which in theory they should not have had. Often you see this kind of cracktivism, if you will, being again a key point by which they can create a chilling effect, where other actions in informational politics, informational action, everyday informational use can very quickly be sort of gathered in a wide net by instituting, again, conditions of social fear sort of corralling the free speech zones, if you will, and then organizing what is available for privacy. That is, only the government has that value of control versus, obviously, the everyday individual not having that sort of right to privacy, as we imagine when we go online. So, again, the authorities often focus on specific individuals to create a chilling effect, and often these individuals are looked at for these kind of cracking actions, as opposed to the wider hacktivist actions.
Well, and joining us to talk a little bit more about the Jeremy Hammond case is Kevin Gostola. He's been covering the case of Jeremy Hammond, and we've had Kevin on to talk about the case of Chelsea Manning. He's also co-author of the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Private Manning, and writer for the Dissenter blog for Fire Dog Lake. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hey,
thanks for staying on. So you covered the case of Jeremy Hammond again. He recently got 10 years in prison, the maximum sentence, for releasing millions of emails relating to the private intelligence firm Stratfor. He called his prison sentence a vengeful, spiteful act designed to put a chill on politically motivated hacking. He did an interview with The Guardian. What really struck you about the case against him and the evidence brought to the table?
Well, I would say, first off, what's striking is the role of the FBI in this case. And I don't want to get into too many details, but quickly I would say that if you look at it, it is clear that the FBI had some sort of knowledge of what these hackers were involved in, what Jeremy and his their cohorts were involved in doing, and some of the websites that were being selected for targeting. And the main thing is that Stratfor, this private intelligence firm, whatever you think of it, ended up being sacrificed. Typically, and I could be wrong, but typically when you are doing this sort of thing with an informant, it resembles a sting operation, I would think. And when you've seen these in alleged terrorism suspect cases where they go after Muslims, they take them to the point of where they're going to blow up the explosives, and then they hit the button, nothing happens, and those people are arrested. Well, it's not what happened here with Stratfor or these other targets. They actually wanted these people to break into these firms and violate them, it appears, and actually go on through and commit these crimes. And in the process of doing this, they destroyed Stratfor.
What effect do you think this will have on the hacker community in the future? If some of these members of Anonymous want to break into corporations in the future, are you hearing anything from them about how this 10-year sentence will affect their work?
I think that you're still going to see it happening because the climate hasn't changed. It hasn't shifted. It's still the same for the Justice Department that they're going to come prosecute these people, but it's still the same for people who affiliate themselves with Anonymous or these hacktivist groups and believe in the goodness of their actions. And so because the climate hasn't shifted, I would say that this would continue. But maybe in hearing some of what Jeremy Hammond said in his statement, and sort of admitting that in some ways he went a little bit too far, maybe, you know, revealing some information that possibly wasn't specific to revealing wrongdoing or misconduct, but, you know, they just release it all, right? And that's one of the key criticisms is a lot of these hacks, when they go in and they reveal the information, they're releasing it all. And maybe some people in Anonymous might become more targeted in their releases and not decide to release it all necessarily.
And Hadar, what do you think we can expect from these groups, just in light of what we're seeing with the people who've already been sentenced and Edward Snowden and Julian Assange? I mean, what's to come from these groups?
You know, in the same way that some of the things we're seeing from these groups would have been unimaginable 20 years ago, it's kind of hard to think what things are going to look like 20 years from now. Mm. I expect that because we have the skills, the technology, the ability to do these things, and because our modes of protest have changed somewhat, we might see more sophisticated ways of exposing information and you know, trying to avoid the consequences. I mean, as we're talking and as I'm listening to the other speakers, I'm thinking about how shocked the nation was during the Watergate disclosures, that somebody would eavesdrop or break into the offices of the Democratic Party, and that somebody would be the president was pretty shocking. I don't know if we would be this shocked today. And the changes in culture and the changes in technology are going to mean changes in the modes of protest and the way that the government's going to perceive them and in the ways that activists are going to respond.
Hadar Aviram is professor of law at UC Hastings and co-chair of the Institute for Criminal Justice. She's writing a book called Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment. Ricardo Dominguez is associate professor in the Visual Arts Department at the University of San Francisco, co-founder of the hacktivist group The Electronic Disturbance, and Kevin Gostola has been covering the case of Jeremy Hammond. He writes the Dissenter blog for Firedog Lake. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can find more information about these cases at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. How are independent musicians making a living? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how the internet continues to change the music economy. Because of services like Spotify and YouTube, musicians are constantly looking for new ways to make money. How do these services compensate musicians? And as for touring, even musicians who have a solid fan base say it's difficult to get the number of bookings they need to earn a living. So how are independent musicians surviving? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.